comments and views expressed on The Kevin Smith Show are those of the people that make them and do not necessarily reflect the views of Kevin Smith, The Kevin Smith Show, or its affiliates or sponsors.
And welcome to the Kevin Smith Show, ladies and gentlemen, whoever you are, wherever you are, all around this beautiful place we call Earth. Thank you for being here at the Kevin Smith Show. Talk radio like nowhere else on the planet. It's the show where you matter. We're here because you have a right to know. Well, I've been getting quite a bit of email in response to that article that I sent out in the special edition of the K-Files, sent it out yesterday. And I want to thank each and every one of you who has emailed your response, your reply, your thoughts, your comments to me. I appreciate you taking the time to do that, and I appreciate knowing what you think about those things. Now, if you're not subscribed to the K-Files, it's free, and you can unsubscribe anytime you want to, so there's really no reason for you to not be subscribed. So if you're not subscribed yet, get over to my website, kevinsmithshow.com. Click where it says K-Files, right in the middle of the screen, you can't miss it, and subscribe. You know, once in a while, we run into comments where someone says, well, I've never heard of this show before. Okay. That's fair enough. It's a big world and there are a whole bunch of shows out there. But we're not new and we're not small. And on the 11th of this month, we will have been at this for 11 years now. And you know, it's been a great 11 years. I hope we have another 11 or more than that. But in that period of time, in that 11 years, I have said often on this show, I've said it very often, that I think that there is evidence that we have had on this planet highly sophisticated and technologically advanced civilizations long, long, long before our current little spot on the map. The remnants of those civilizations are all around us. Sometimes they are covered in sand and dirt, and we have to dig them up, but sometimes they're just right out in front of us, and we fail to see them. And I think maybe we fail to see them, to perceive that that's what we're looking at, because our minds are already predisposed to think that's impossible. We think if you go back to the dawn of civilization, that takes us back to the Sumerians, that there was nothing civilized back beyond that. Well, I think the evidence shows that there were highly sophisticated, highly technological societies back then, long before the Sumerians. That's what we're going to be talking about here tonight. We're going to be talking about evidence that indicates that there were highly sophisticated, highly knowledgeable societies, civilizations, long before the so-called dawn of civilization. You don't want to miss this. We'll be back right after this. And welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. My guest this evening is John Jensen, and John Jensen is a retired pulp and paper startup training specialist. He's written over 160 technical books on paper machine operations, pulp mill operations, wood yard and chemical plant operations, and he's produced over 17 running hours of industrial video, as well as many other training programs in various multimedia formats. Some of the clients that we might say are in his resume include many of the Fortune 50 companies like Weyerhaeuser, James River, Mead, International Paper. He's recognized as one of the seminal thinkers in establishing technical startup training as a part of greenfield or major modernization projects. His lifelong passion has been the study and research of ancient and prehistoric civilizations. He's also interested in history of the early Middle Ages and the Knights Templar, and he has written a book about the ancient canal builders of America. John Jensen, welcome to the Kevin Smith Show.
Thank you, Kevin. Can you hear me okay?
We hear you just super.
Okay, great.
Thank you
for having me.
Now, John, the reason I read all of that about, pardon me, your background, is I want people to understand that whenever you are, whenever you research and whenever you write, you pay a lot of attention to the details of what other research has gone before you. Some people are not familiar, for instance, with a paper mill. Maybe they've never seen one. If you ever see one, you ever get to go in one, you will realize that it's very, very technical, and people have to know exactly what they're doing. If they don't know what they're doing, they get hurt severely, and they can die. And I happen to have lived for a number of years in the shadow of a paper mill and have known of several disasters where someone didn't do something right and people got hurt, and in some cases people died. So writing training manuals and doing training videos for that type of an operation is very, very technical. It's very precise. But having said that, you also make it clear that you are not a geologist, you're not an archaeologist, but you're looking at things that geologists and archaeologists have discovered, as well as some things that you have seen, and you put them together in your book. Now, let me ask you a question. How did you get interested in canals, as opposed to, say, the great monuments in South America? How did you get interested in canals?
Well, that's a great question. I've been interested in the literature and information around great monoliths. Are you there?
We're listening to you, John. John, go ahead.
Oh, okay. I've been interested in those other things for a very long time. I just happened to be doing some independent research in around some Civil War information on the internet, particularly Google Earth, and I was looking at some an old fort down around Sulphur, Louisiana, and in that process, I noticed a on the Google Earth image, I noticed a map that I had seen on an ancient map from 1863 or 64, detailing that area during the Civil War. Well, obviously that was before oil exploration or anything else. So the canal, if it existed then and shows now, it must predate time. So I went to look at it further And as I panned back, all of a sudden I saw many interconnected canals running across the Mississippi from south to the area of the Gulf now that has had so much problems, Venice and that area.
Yeah, John, your phone is breaking up really, really, really bad. We're having a hard time understanding what you're saying. Tell you what let's do. Let me put some music on, and we'll try to reestablish contact on get a better line here. We'll be back, folks, right after this. We've got our guest back on the line with us. So, John, you were looking on Google Earth at this fort down this area around Fort down around Sulphur, Louisiana, and as you pan back, you begin to see what now?
I see many more canals degraded and falling under the water table, and then showing back up again some distance later, going south and some going west, and as I began to follow them, I realized I was looking at something that was probably quite old, having some experience in working on the water and around it. I understood that if a canal was, or a, at that time I wasn't even sure they were canals, they were just lines of what appeared to be berm or piled up residue, bank residue, but when it fell underwater, I wasn't sure. But if it were, they were that long and that big and degraded under the water table, they were obviously older. And so I kept up the study, and within weeks, I did it every day. It was so interesting that I looked at literally hundreds of miles of these canals all over the Mississippi Delta. And then as I started to extend out, I started finding them in Florida, both coasts, the Gulf Coast and the Atlantic Coast, and then moving up, found them all the way up and down most of the Atlantic Coast, lots in New Jersey, part of it in the inland waterway areas, nothing very, or almost nothing out in open beachfront Atlantic Ocean. Almost everything is inside in the intercoastal waterway areas, or inside the breakers, basically. They're not out on the ocean.
And what did that indicate to you?
Well, at first, it was several weeks to months before I could really catalog what I was looking at in just in what I was looking at, and many months after that before I got to a point where I could start understanding what the timing was around being able to measure them. I got some help from geologists and different folks that said, look, the ocean has risen a particular amount over the last 10,000 years since the basic ice melt surge. And we know what that is very precisely. It's even better a dating method than, say, carbon 14 that is affected by so many external things like saline content in water and various things, whereas water table rise is very precise. We can measure it right to inches for particular dates. What I found out in that research is that the world's ocean has risen in the last just over 7,000 years of a varied amount in different parts of the world. But here on the Atlantic seaboard, which is what I'm measuring, the tables, the water tables are called the Jamaica Plain water table. That raise has been almost exactly 5 feet 4 inches in the last 7,100 years. From 7,100 years ago to about 6,000 years ago, or the first 1,000 years of that measurement, it rose about three and a half feet. From 6,000 to 5,000, it rose about a foot and a half. And it's been almost perfectly stable since 5,000 years ago. So that what that tells me, when I look at areas that are underwater, then I look at is the berm edge or the residue of digging, how far underwater is it? Well, with the Louisiana channels, most of them fit almost perfectly within the 5 foot table raise to put them at 7,100 years old. Several of them are slightly shallower than that, so there were, it looked like to me for a long time that there were two different age frames for some of the channels. The long, narrow, the long, wide, straight canals are from the 7,100 date, and some of the shorter ones are a little bit newer that cross over them. The canals and channels in Florida all have, I haven't been out on site and tested every one of them, but they all fall within that 5 to 6 foot range of water table, meaning that they're the majority of what I have on my website and in my research is almost certainly dated to 7,100 years ago.
Before I do a show, it's my practice, and I do this every day. It's my practice to go onto the internet and see what's being said on forums out there. What are people saying about either the guest or the topic or both? And the internet is pretty crazy place. Everybody's an expert. Even people who have never even read anything about the topic become experts. But it's very instructive. It's very interesting because I would have assumed, because of places I've lived and things that I just know generally because of, you know, having been around for a number of years, I would assume that most people understand that there is substantial evidence that there were people of intellectual sophistication and technological sophistication a long, long, long time ago before our current era. And the problem with that is when I got onto these forums, I ran into posts where people were saying that the canal builder theory, I can't buy that, and there's no evidence for that, and all that. But you know, John, one of America's major cities exists specifically because of the canals built by prehistoric people. And I, during one of the breaks, folks, if you're watching our show, during the break right at the top of the hour, you're going to see that story. There is one of America's major cities that exists specifically because of ancient canals. And I guess where I'm headed with this is, have you run into that? Have you run into people saying, oh, come on now, there's no evidence for this?
Oh, sure. You know, the same folks that, you know, that's really not my audience to begin with, is there are two groups of folks that, you know, deny anything that doesn't match the philosophy that Clovis was the first one here. Mm-hmm. Nothing before Clovis, NBC, is a, you know, is a, the watchword in American archaeology, and so anything that flies in the face of that is just either laughed off. You know, a great example is not even my find, but someone else's, is the Wendover Bog folks down in Florida that are DNA tested to be European. They're DNA tested to be about, they're carbon tested to be about 8,500 years ago. They, a whole colony that could weave cloth, woven cloth on machine woven, was their burial shrouds. Those folks, and that has nothing to do with me, that's just evidence that's laying out there. The least amount of web traffic ever is on the videos on YouTube about the Wendover Bog people, and the deafening silence is amazing to me, that if you can't argue the evidence, then just ignore it.
Mm-hmm. Or try to bury it.
Yeah, is either just disclaim it outright without looking at the evidence or arguing the evidence. One of the things I might interrupt my narrative and say is that I've had three different occasions where folks have sent me evidence that said, what you're showing is modern and here's why, and sent me photographs and other evidence to show, and I went, yep, you're right, and I took that information off my website. I have no vested interest in putting evidence out that's either incorrect or wrong. So if anyone wants to argue the evidence, you know, have right at it. If you're right, I'll take it down. But if you're not, don't just make light of it in silly nonsense kinds of ways, because that has, and on the other side of it, we can't take the evidence and then postulate silly theories with it either. And I don't try to do either one. I don't make the case for or against Atlantis or the flood or the biblical flood or anything else. I'm just looking at the evidence and saying, here it is.
Mm-hmm.
This is what it is, and this is what it appears to be to me. If I were gathering all this evidence and looking at it, here's what I would say it looks like, but not why or any outlandish theories that I can't prove of where it came from, who they were, anything like that.
Well, we have to step away for break, and we'll be back right after this, so don't go away, folks. Welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. We are talking with John Jensen. He is the author of Ancient Canal Builders of America. And we're talking about this ancient evidence, actually current evidence, of ancient technology. John.
Go ahead.
Oh, my. This time of year, I have allergy attacks, and I refuse, okay, ladies and gentlemen, to take pharmaceuticals for it. I won't do it. Okay, we were talking about these ancient canals, and we were talking about one of the things that you brought up is. And all through your work, you bring this up, but you've brought it up here a couple of times, that about 7,100 years ago, something happened.
Right.
Okay, what are we talking about? What happened?
Well, what we have is somewhere around 100 locations that show a water depth of about
just slightly over 5 feet to the, you know, to the underwater edge of that canal or whatever. So it's almost a standard depth that we're looking at just over 5 feet, which puts all of that, the canals up in New York, Long Island Sound, Jones Beach, some of that stuff is a duplicate of what we have in Louisiana, all at the same depth level of what we term the tertiary tidal shoulder, where the land and water met, and that's all of it is universally of just over 5 feet underwater, all up and down the coast, and that's a very good measurement tool to say that whatever stopped that civilization, whatever wiped it off the face of the earth, so that there's no vestiges left except the harbors and the canals and the channels, the underwater things are all that are left. We can date that almost precisely by its depth to 7,100 years ago. In addition to that, we have, I found about a year later after I found the canals, a cause event that would create an Atlantic-based tsunami large enough to wipe off that entire population, that tsunami being what's called the Storiega methane gas explosion and landslide in the North Atlantic, and that's dated by paleogeologists and oceanographers to exactly 7,100 years ago. So when we can tie the cause to an effect, the loss of this entire population, and the only remnants that are left are their canals and their channels and waterways, habitation canals, and so on. The only evidence that they were ever here is our underwater elements. When people say, well, people will ask me, well, if they were here, why can't you find any remnants of them? Because the devastation was so great from the Storiega event and the tsunami that followed, that it wiped everything off. That was a cataclysmic event.
So in some places, as far as 22 miles inland are now underwater. For instance, at Galveston Bay.
What do you mean? I'm not sure what you mean. Say it again.
Well, according to what you've written, at Galveston Bay, at about that time, the boundary land between the river and the bay receded by 35 kilometers upstream. So that's 22 miles. That's 22 miles went underwater.
Right. So that is evidence of a tsunami of major proportion that washes inland 22 miles. There's beginning to show evidence, and I'm talking to oceanographers and geologists now that are looking at Mobile Bay in Mobile, Alabama, as having residue of the same proportion. So the entire Gulf was overrun by a tsunami that ran inland at least 22 miles that we know of, 35 kilometers. In addition to that, we have what's called the Bosporus Strait breach in the Mediterranean, and that also happened 7,100 years ago. That's been dated by geologists at occurring at exactly 7,100 years ago. And the only fly in the ointment right now, actually there's two or three of them, is that there's some data that this tsunami was also around on the Pacific side. We're just getting into that data now. We found out that in Maquila Bay in Chile, there's a wash, a tsunami debris, detritus wash, that's about 7 meters high, which is in the 25-foot range, 23 to 25 foot high, a mile inland. When it's any oceanographers or geologists that are listening will tell you that when a tsunami wash is that high, the actual tsunami itself crest was incredibly large. We know from recent tsunamis that the amount of debris that's carried in the backwash is proportionally quite small compared to the height of the tsunami itself, the wave. And so if we have a 25-foot pile of debris, the tsunami itself was gigantic. The only problem with that data is not that it isn't true. It is. All you have to do is just go look at the actual debris field and date it with carbon dating, and you'll get the information I've just relayed. The problem is that it's on the Pacific Coast. It's dated to the same years as the Atlantic Coast, but it's on the Pacific. That means that we're now looking at something that was it's beginning to appear that it wasn't just the Storiega event, that it was a global event rather than just an Atlantic event. So we're looking into that now, trying to piece together other information that is on the Pacific side, because if we have a global event of that magnitude, it not only took out the ancient canal builders, but other civilization, remnants of other civilizations in many places on the globe. So that's where we're looking at that now.
All right, now you write about the fact that this big mega calamity took place 7,100 years ago, but that also there was a smaller calamity, still a big catastrophe, but a smaller in scale, about 3,100 years ago.
Yeah, that information is really well known in the archaeological literature. It's not new to me. Almost one of the reasons that contemporary or academia will accept a 3,100 year ago catastrophe, level of catastrophe, because it fits within the Aboriginal Clovis mentality. It fits inside of that. There's a lot of literature that says the Atlantic coast was inundated with a tsunami of fairly significant proportion that destroyed most of the cultures and interaction of tribal or cultural interaction between groups for about 500 years, from 3,100 to 2,500 years ago, particularly in the Atlantic Gulf area and the island areas, where there was a major discontinuation of culture there for about 600 years, and that's really well documented in literature and well accepted in most academic circles, as folks like Ed Grandin and people like that have researched that data extensively have documented its. But it was not the mega tsunami or the mega disaster that the 7,100 year ago event was. That event let me back up and say that the 3,100 year ago event was big enough to have caused the breach in Gibraltar Strait into the Mediterranean. Up until that time, the Mediterranean had been closed. The reason that I say that is that simple regression mathematics will demonstrate that it was only 3,100 years ago that the Gibraltar Strait was breached, simply because of its historical widening over that period of time. We have records, observational measurements and records of the Gibraltar Strait from about 600 years BC, in that range, and we know, or at least 500, when the Greeks measured it at four miles wide, when Julius Caesar's troops fighting in North Africa measured the street, it was 750. So in 500 years, it had opened up 3 miles. 1,200 years later, at the time that the English were going into the Mediterranean in the large ships going to what's now Palestine and the Crusade area, they measured the Gibraltar Strait at 12 miles wide. And today, 800 years later, it's 15 miles wide. So we have a regression that you can look at, and if you triangulate that regression back, it only goes to 3,100 years ago. And you can't argue with that kind of geological regression, because if it opened up or widened out from 4 miles to 15 miles in the years across from 500 BC to now, then it's pretty easy to regress it back to its original point.
Okay.
We know the 3,100 year ago event was significant enough to breach the Gibraltar Strait.
All right, now this date of 7,100 years ago, there's one point in your writing here. For instance, when you talk about Galveston Bay, you give us a date of 7,300 years down to 7,100 years.
Well, that's the archaeologist. I'm sorry, excuse me. The geologist that did that study, that's their dates.
Well, my question for me. Yeah, my question would be, when we say 7,100. If it was 7,200 or 7,300 years, we're still talking about basically the same time period, right?
Well, all I'm saying about that date is that those folks put that time frame on it, and so I published that same information, but it's close enough to be the same event, as far as I'm concerned.
Mm-hmm.
It stretches credibility that it would be 7,200 when everything else is the measures.
Okay, we have to step away for a break. We'll pick up there when we come back. And I've got some real tough questions coming up about canals and the people that built them. We'll be back. Welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. My guest is John Jensen. And, John, so far, what we've been doing is sort of laying the groundwork here that something happened 7,100 years ago.
Right.
Something big, and it's beginning to look like perhaps it was worldwide. But something big happened, and the evidence that you've looked at is the evidence that's along the coastlines here in America.
Right.
And you've looked at what geologists and paleogeologists and archaeologists say about all of this, and you've combined that into your book.
Right.
7,100 years ago is not when these civilizations were thriving, it's when they ended.
Right.
That means that these civilizations, in order to have built these great canals and harbors and so forth that you're talking about, would have had to have been around for a long time prior to 7,100 years ago.
Let me argue with you about that.
All right.
Here's a different theory. Civilization from the point that we were a feudal tribal community to where we put a man on the moon is less than 400 years. we were burning people at the stake for not being religious enough or too religious or whatever, or for being witches, no more than 400 years ago. And 50 years ago, we put a man on the moon. Or, I'm sorry, for whatever it was.
About 40-something.
Yeah, so the distance between a group of people moving from a tribal society or a feudal society to a culture is demonstrated to be less than 400, 500 years.
Good point.
400, 500 years, because we did. So my argument is that it does not take centuries upon centuries upon centuries at all. It takes a very short amount of time because we've demonstrated that we can do that as a, you know, in our civilization. Here's my basic argument with folks that postulate theories of God's helped us do it, or the aliens helped us do it, or whatever, is nobody helped us do it in the last 400 years. We did it ourselves. We're extremely, human beings are extremely territorial. We fight over anything, including the, you know, the state of the weather. We are very aggressive, and as and build societies very quickly. We've demonstrated that we do it. I don't have a bit of problem of picking up our 500-year history and placing it anywhere in the historical record and saying, if we could do it, they could.
That's a good point.
And that's my basic argument.
So how far back do you think these civilizations go?
Well, here's what I'm prepared to probably announce on your show for the first time, is that this cataclysm that occurred 7,100 years ago happens very regularly and wipes out entire civilizations on a global scale when it does it. How many times has that occurred? I have no idea. I'm not a specialist in ancient civilizations around the world to be able to say one is this period of time. All I'm saying is that I can prove, to my own satisfaction at least, and I hope other reviewers, that a major global cataclysm occurred 7,100 years ago and wiped out a major population. And the evidence that I'm putting out there suggests it was a very large population. It didn't take very long to build up. It didn't take centuries upon centuries. It didn't take thousands of years. It took a very short amount of time. What I think is that the derivative cultures that came out of that cataclysm are the remnants of the sophisticated civilizations that were there. What I mean by that is that the Sumerians, for an example, rose up with a full-blooded, full, sophisticated civilization 6,000 years ago. It's only 1,000 years after this major cataclysm. And when they rose up, they came with an entirely sophisticated civilization, laws, banking, writing, communication systems, whole government systems, and so on. And it just stretches the imagination to think that four of the world's leading civilizations all sprang upon the world stage between 6,000 and 5,500 years ago, all of a sudden, all over the world. They're what I term derivative cultures. They derive from the remnant survivors of the earlier culture, and they carried with them the legends of that survival. They carried with them some of the pieces that were saved and kept and eventually copied and as things like Charles Hapgood's maps of the ancient sea kings and so on. They're obviously copies of something that existed before. So these cultures, in my opinion, are derivative cultures of that cataclysm. We have derivative cultures here on In Louisiana and Florida, they're called mound builders. We call them shell mound builders here. In Louisiana, they're called earth mound builders. But they're dated to about 5,500 years ago. So something around 1,000 to 1,500 years after the cataclysm, cultures begin to survive and grow and thrive again, some of them with some distinct portions of that previous culture handed down in the form of legends and so on. So your question was, did it happen before? The answer is yes, I think that it did, although it's not going to be part of my study to determine how many times. But I think at this level, from a personal viewpoint, that it happens about every 7,000 years, about.
Well, so we're due for one.
Are we due for another one? I think we're in the beginning stages of it already. You can start to see the island of Java has sank 25 feet in the last 4 months. Australia's starting to move underwater and losing its starting to sink. Our weather patterns are changing dramatically, obviously, from just this last week. I think it's already beginning to start to show that it's coming close on us now. But it does occur. Now, the problem that I've got is being able to document the exact ranges. It isn't exactly 7,000 years. Sometimes it's less, sometimes it's more. But it averages 7,000 years.
All right. Now, if this is a cyclical thing, I understand what you said about it didn't take us long to go from tribal to what we are now. However, look how long we were at tribal. If you go back 6,000 years to the Sumerians, from then until now is how long it took to get here.
Yeah, but no, it didn't work like that. Wait, your history tells you that it didn't work like that. The Sumerians were a very sophisticated, declining technology, meaning that their population base wasn't large enough to sustain the technology that they came with. They were better at the beginning than they were at any time until their demise 3,000 years later. Exact same is true of the Egyptians. They were better at their beginning. Their highest technology was at the beginning of the old kingdom, and their everything was lesser. So,
okay, we have to step away for break. But we'll pick up there with the declining technology when we come back. Welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. My guest this evening, John Jensen. We're talking about ancient canal builders in America. And let me welcome those of you who have joined us just now in this second hour. My sincere sympathy to you for whatever it is that kept you away for the first hour. But we're glad you're here now. As we went away for break, John Jensen was pointing out that the Sumerian civilization was better technologically at their beginning than they were at the end. And this was true also of the Egyptians. And then the break took over and it cut you off in mid-sentence. So I want to give the floor to you and you can finish that thought.
Okay, thanks. The point was that civilizations that were derivative, what I think were derivative cultures of the major civilization, were at their best at their beginning, and then they declined, and basically civilizations have come and gone in the process. The one that nearly made high technology were the Greeks about 500 years B.C., about 2,500 years ago, and they came very close to high technology. Everything is, you know, much of what we have now as a civilization relates back to information from that period of time, and I think, in my opinion, that that was all derivative culture information. I think that the it's just back to the point that it doesn't take a long time for a civilization to erupt, particularly if any of the surviving remnants of a civilization keep any of the technology. And this ties into some ideas about what might have been contained in the libraries at Alexandria prior to their destruction. Some of the ancient manuscripts and writings, as evidenced by, like Charles Hapgood with his maps of the ancient sea kings, that kind of documentation is shows that there was data and information available in some kind of written or communicatable form long before Western civilization evolved enough to really understand what they were looking at. And I think Hapgood's one of the first guys that really hit it on the head that, you know, wherever this came from, it was predecessor knowledge of particularly the Atlantic, Antarctica, and so on.
Okay, so this original civilization, as I'll term it that, I don't know what you call it, but the one before this great disaster 7,100 years ago, what levels of high technology would they have reached, do you think?
Well, the remnant cultures all retain mythology of flying, of rockets, particularly the Indian from the continent of India, from the country of India. Their religious documentation all talk about flying machines in very practical ways, non-mythological ways.
Mm-hmm.
The Sumerians talked about rockets and battles that were fought in the sky and so on. So it's not a stretch for me to see the predecessor civilization having at least the amount of technology that we have, if not greater. One of the previous civilizations obviously was able to fly, had rockets and so on, because we see so much evidence of that around the world in drawings and so forth, information that says there was that capability was available at some point in time in the past. It's much easier for me to deal with it being a civilization that existed prior to a cataclysm that had that technology than to assign it to the gods from outer space. I mean, no disrespect to the people that come up with those theories, but it's just, it makes much more rational sense to say we did it. We did it then, we do it now.
Well, it does, depending on what presuppositional stance you take. To those folks, it seems much more rational to take the position they take. But
sure.
Now let me ask you this. This predecessor civilization, do you think that there was before that one, before that predecessor civilization, was there yet another predecessor civilization that was high tech?
Absolutely, not even a question. The some remnants that we find, Göbel Tepe, Tiwanaku, the the stones of Baalbek, some of the megalithic cultures are obviously much older. Having stood on the ground at Pumapunku, I've looked at the ground, and as an old sailor and not a technologist, I can tell you without question that that's alluvial soil. Because when you kick it open and you find barnacles, barnacle shells, it doesn't take a genius to figure out that the ocean covered that at one time. That's my opinion. I'm just a layman with an opinion. But what I'm saying is that there are many remnant elements of civilizations that existed at different time frames around the world pre mountain building in Peru, and Bolivia, where Tiwanaku is, Baalbek, Lebanon, the pyramids, and so on. The pyramids, in my understanding, and I am not a pyramidologist or a specialist in that arena and don't claim to be, but my understanding was that the caliph of Cairo, when he had the casing stripped from the great Cheops pyramid to build his caliphate in downtown Cairo in the 1200s, 1240 or whatever it was, that his men documented a salt ring at 250-some feet up on Cheops pyramid. Now, I don't know that that's true. I wasn't there. But that's recorded in history as true. There are several people that have said that there are salt incrustations in the Queen's pyramid at about the same level, but they don't extend up to the King's level. So if we have a salt line, a residue salt line on the Great Pyramid at 255 feet, it doesn't take a lot of genius to figure out it was covered in water,
mm-hmm.
salt water at some point in time. That's my opinion. Again, I'm not an expert, but it just rationally makes sense to me that that's what that evidence suggests. If that's true, we have a man-made artifact of building the Great Pyramid that existed prior to being inundated at one point in time, which suggests that if it were inundated, that's two cycles. It was built when it was before it was inundated, then it was inundated, now it's not. So that's two complete cycles at least. Maybe another one occurred and it wasn't inundated. It happened to be in a place where I don't know. So how many times does it go back? The evidence that we see in on a global scale suggests several times. I don't know how many, but I think civilization has come and gone on the surface of the Earth to match that periodic cycle regularly. I think that it comes and wipes us off and starts again on a real regular basis. That's just my opinion, and this is the first time that I've really made that statement anywhere. I've been doing this research for 2 years, and I've just recently got to the point to where I can make that the evidence says that to me. It doesn't mean that that's what it was. It's just what it says to me.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, based on what it says to you, and based on what you have said to us, that you think that this next cycle is already underway.
Right.
I'm not going to ask you to predict anything about what's coming, but I want to go back to what's happened. How large was the Earth's population at the last great catastrophe 7,100 years ago, and what was it reduced to?
I'm just guessing. All I can do is just guess. But the evidence that I see on just the Atlantic and Gulf Coast of the United States, just that evidence, says that at a minimum that population on the Atlantic Rim alone was something in the, I'm going to say ballpark of 300 million people. Ballpark. Probably bigger. Now, the reason I say probably bigger is because if you look at the copper mines in Upper Michigan and start extrapolating the concept of 1.5 billion pounds of copper being mined at some period in the remote past, probably well past 7,000 years ago, 1.5 billion pounds, when you say it quickly, doesn't mean very much. But ask any miner, any rock quarry guy in the world, what that means in terms of ore removal. And if you remove 1.5 billion pounds, which is in the magnitude of 100 million tons. Now, let's put that in some perspective. The Panama Canal was built in several years by some of the best engineers in the world with the best earth-moving equipment that you could find and so forth and so on. And as a project, it only moved about 40 million tons of stone. Okay, as a complete total project, the whole Panama Canal. So when you talk about removing through mining 100 million tons of ore, it isn't 100 million tons of material moved, it's 100 million tons of ore, so that you get a much larger number of the amount of raw material moved. That is industrial mining on a scale that equates to anything that we do today anywhere in the world. So you have a population that was using that level of mined ore, 1.5 billion pounds. That's major industrial strength mining. So the civilization that consumed it had to be seriously large. As you know, we're what, 7 billion people on the earth today, or 6.5, and that's still a large chunk of ore, even for a population as big as we are. So to have that much mining done, it wasn't done with deer horn antlers and a couple of woven baskets on some aboriginals' heads. I'll guarantee you that it was done in a much more industrial way than that. So where did it go? How was that kind of quantity used? It had to be consumed by a fairly large population. I'm saying all of that to try to answer your question. I don't know how many there were. I'm going to guess anywhere up from 300 million up to whatever. I don't know.
Okay, but now that's just the population on the Atlantic coast,
right,
of the United States of America. Is that right?
Yeah. Well, no, on the Atlantic. No, I'm saying the entire Atlantic Rim. We call it the Atlantic Rim dispersion theory.
Yeah.
That says all the way around the Atlantic Rim is a population that we can identify by its canals and its earthwork and city planning and so on. All around it, there may or may not have been a central population base that was also destroyed or submerged at the same time in the Atlantic. The idea that there was a population base is supported in mythology and information that's kept by social structure since. I mean, that idea has been around since Ignatius Donnelly and antediluvian world and so on. There certainly could have been and probably was some kind of central location where this major population was centered out of, and the colonies or the civilization around the Atlantic Rim were colonies of that central population. Now, this is not a theory for Atlantis. Please understand that. It's not even in my purview to make a case for Atlantis or against it. It's just likely that because of the way that the colonies are spread around the Atlantic Rim, that including North America, the Eastern Atlantic Seaboard, the Gulf Coast, and so on, and to a great extent, the islands down through the Caribbean, that show, particularly Cuba and the Bahamas, that show underwater remnants of culture of some kind at admittedly different time frames than mine, but they still show those remnants, means that shifting Earth, the crustal plate in the Atlantic particularly, could have risen and fallen and stretched in ways that could have decimated a whole landmass, particularly when you think about the Storegga landslide being 600 miles wide at its widest point. That's an enormously large area. If the undersea landslide was that great, 600 miles long, and we have no idea right now how what might have occurred with that kind of disturbance on the ocean floor of a 600 mile long landslide. So that it very well could have included the submergence of other land masses.
Okay, so we're looking at a population of around 300 to 500 million or more around this Atlantic rim. After the great catastrophe, how many were left?
Not very many. If I had to bet, I would say a million folks. There's no way to tell, but if you just look at the derivative culture population and the estimated populations in the Euphrates Valley, which is the Sumerians, in the Indus Valley civilizations, which is Afghanistan and Pakistan and India, if you look at the canal builders, their derivative cultures here, and try to multiply that on a global basis, there weren't many. It wasn't a lot. I would say, it's just a wild ass guess, but I'd guess a million people.
All right, now you got a million people left over. Obviously, not everyone in that civilization was at the upper level of knowledge and training and so forth. So you've got a mix probably in that million. You've got a mix of a few people that were at the upper level. You got a few people that were mid-management. You got a few people that, were bums. You got a few people that were at the worker level. And so everything from bum to worker level to genius level, but there's not very many of them, and they're spread out around that rim. How would they be able, because that Atlantic rim is that's a long area, and their technology has just been destroyed. So how would they be able to communicate and get together and form a derivative civilization?
I think that each developed out of a group that survived in that particular area.
So it was like a local thing.
Right, it was local.
Mm-hmm.
The Sumerians didn't know at the time very much about the Indus Valley culture. They didn't know anything to speak of the mound builders and the shell mound builders on the Atlantic coast. However, they did retain some knowledge of where the ore was, because the ore kept continuing to be produced up in the upper Michigan through that time frame down into our more modern times. And so some of that data was retained. Somebody was a keeper of the keys of data, the information, and so on. I'm a personal believer. It's just me. I'm not trying to proselytize the theory, but I think that the tables of the law that Abraham took out of Mesopotamia, took to Egypt, which became the stones that eventually the Templars got, I think that those were remnants of that previous civilization. They were technological remnants of some kind, and I'm almost certain of that. In my own mind, I have no way to prove it because we can't get our hands on them. They're too well hidden at this point in time, but that's what I think they were.
Okay. Now, earlier I didn't ask you to make a prediction, but based on what you've said, I understand it'll be your opinion, your speculation, but what do you see in this current round that you say you think it's already underway? What do you see as a possibility for what's going to be left after this round of disaster?
I'm sorry to be the bearer of bad news, but not much. Mm-hmm. There's if it occurs this time like it occurred in the past and has, and we can pretty well document it in many arenas, and other people have done it better than me. We know that the cataclysm was horrific, that there was little or no major civilization that was retained except just remnants or pieces of it. The same thing will occur this time. If it does occur, again, I'm just dealing with data as I see it and time frames as I'm uncovering it, and it appears that we're on that cycle. Based on the things that are beginning to occur, but the earthquakes, the tsunami in Japan, the things that are that are occurring, if it does the same thing that it did last time, there isn't much left. We start over, and hopefully someone will have a you know, the more than a database of seeds that are stored up in the Nordic countries that to reseed the earth. Of course, I think that's been done before. I think that reseeding the.
All right, we have to step away for break. We'll be back right after this. Welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show, where I am battling the allergies this evening. My guest is John Jensen. And John, when we went away for break, we were talking about what's going to happen in the next round of disaster, which you think is already underway. And you were saying there's not going to be much left. But in the last round of disaster, doesn't the evidence show that most of the population was gathered pretty much close to the coastline? Whereas now, although we have a great deal of population around the coastlines, we also have inland, great distances inland, big portions of the population that would survive this, wouldn't they?
Well, I don't think so for this reason. If the catastrophism is at the level I believe it to be, a washing of the globe or a sloshing of the oceans across all land, and building, mountain building and submergence of land, the reordering of the surface of the globe basically, would probably decimate inland folks as easily or as much as it would any other, coastal or any other. If the coasts retain their shape, have no idea or knowledge that they will or won't. I don't think that they did on the last go around. I don't think that we retained an entire globe of continental shape. We retained some of it, and we in this area have examples of it. But we very well could have had some of the mountain building in the West Coast occur during that period, and if it did, and there was a Pacific submergence of land that drove up the mountain building on the West Coast, and that occurred at that time, it probably would have taken out entire land-based populations as well as coastal-based populations. At least that's my opinion.
Okay, so how did this million or so people survive if there was a whole washing of the surface like that?
Well, when I say the sloshing event may not have been the entire surface. There may have been land masses. For an example, I can't point to any particular land space other than the Rocky Mountains and say I've seen too many clam beds at 5,000 foot elevation in the Rocky Mountains to not know they were at one time ocean edge and or underwater. I mean, it's obvious that they were. I don't know when that occurred, but if it was part of this particular catastrophe 7,100 years ago, then it's hard to predict what portions of land stayed relatively safe and which were, you know, thrust up out of the water into mountains and so on, mountain building. So there are areas, I'm sure that there are areas that will not sustain great damage or water wash for whatever reason. Some folks are in the water, some people live on the water and may survive because of that. I really don't know. I'm not an expert in that process. I was just telling you an estimated idea of the numbers of survivors based on the cultures that were left. Whether or not there were more or less, I don't know. But how do they survive? It's pretty safe to say that a half of 1% is, you know, if you dump gas on an anthill, 1% of them will survive whatever. I mean, I think it's kind of like that. You know, it's just random selection.
Mm-hmm. Just luck. Okay. Now, how long does one of these events take? From the time it starts till you can say that's behind us, how long does that take?
Well, if we look at the geological record and start doing some assumptions on the magnetic direction of lava, for an example, worldwide, and the guys that do this way better than me, guys like Velikovsky and Hapgood and those kinds of guys that have done this kind of study have said that the polar positions have changed several times on the Earth. If it occurred in any kind of cataclysmic way that would change the polarity on the surface of the Earth, and we can demonstrate in the rocks that has occurred. How long would it take? Man, I don't know, but I don't think it would take long. In our religious history, we talk about it occurring in a day, because they talk about the sun standing still for 3.5 or 4 hours. That's retained in cultural memory, so it took a day, give or take. Maybe it took a little longer, but not much. So when it occurs, it's cataclysmic. It may show the Egyptians, for example, talked about the seven plagues. You know, the many of the cultures talk about the coming signs of the devastation. They call it different things. They call it various names, but the cultures talk about as our Christian religion, Judeo-Christian religion, does, of the end times and so on. Again, I'm not advocating for or against the any of those particular philosophies. It's just that that's retained in cultural memory, that certain things that begin to happen are the beginning of that ending. And all I'm saying is it looks like we're looking at those now.
Okay, now this great cataclysm comes in a cycle of approximately 7,100 years. What about the smaller cataclysm from 3,100 years ago? Is that cyclical as well?
I think it is. But I really don't have an idea of why some are, globally catastrophic and others are less. It could be any. I think that the planet is a lot more dynamic and alive and subject to change than we give it any credit for. It's not and of course every gradualist in the world is going to jump up and start calling me a heathen for even talking about that as a concept. But the fact is, if you look at the facts out there, we are living on a living, breathing planet that goes through convulsions and changes on a fairly regular basis. And those changes include shifting of the poles, because we have different pointers to magnetic poles that are not current poles. I mean, that record is in the rocks. So, those things occur. What are the minor ones? Could we have been hit by the remnants of a celestial object? Sure. You know, it's very, very realistic. But would it make as much sense to say that just the functions of a living Earth changing and so on its own could cause some of those minor occurrences too?
Look, I know that you don't either espouse or do you try to dissuade on certain things. For instance, the possibility of Atlantis, the possibility of aliens, etc. That's just not part of the scope of what you've looked at, and that's just, you're not in that gear. That's not what you're looking at. That's not what you're talking about. But it's very, very curious. One of the groups we've talked about here tonight quite a bit is the Sumerians. The Sumerians, of course, are the ones from which that information has come, or at least I'm like you. I don't read Sumerian, so I have to rely upon those who do. And one of the people who says he said he could read Sumerian and wrote a lot of books about it was Zachariah Sitchin.
Right.
And some people say that he made all that up, and some people say, no, he actually translated Sumerian. I'm not in a position to say, because I don't read Sumerian. I read a number of languages. That's not one of them. However, in his information, he said that the Sumerian texts talk about a heavenly body. Some people say it's a planet. Some people say it's a brown dwarf. The Sumerians, according to him, called it Nibiru. It's on a 3,600-year orbit, according to his information. What's curious to me is that fits very, very closely with these cycles. you're at 3,100 years and 7,100 years. If it's on a 3,600-year orbit, then instead of 7,100 years, you'd be looking at 7,200 years. So it's within,
well,
it's within the fudge factor.
Not, I understand your argument. I understand where you're.
No, it's not an argument. It's an observation.
Yeah, I just have a different take on it, and it's this, that the Sumerian chronologies and their history as written down started out originally as a derivative culture, as kind of their carried over mythology, like our Bible is part of their. You know, the story of Noah comes directly out of the Epic of Gilgamesh, and all of that predecessor information derives from some earlier information, and I don't have a problem with it being like our religious documents being allegorical and or as generally accurate as that kind of derivative information would be. It would be, like, if we didn't have any written documentation of the first century AD, we wouldn't have the arguments over what is apocryphal and what is gospel in terms of our own Bibles, Christian Bibles.
Yeah, I want to take a different take on that, though.
But
what if it's not mythology? And here's the possibility. Now, we're about to go to break, and I'm going to let you answer this when we come back from break. Okay, but here's the deal. What if it's not mythology? What if that's how we are assigning it? 1,000 years from now, after we go through this big bust-up that's about to happen, according to what you think is about to happen, 1,000 years from now, when it all, the civilization starts to sort of come together and it's a derivative civilization, and someone brings out the records of the first man on the moon and all the news reports, 1,000 years from now, well, 1,000 years further down the road, someone is going to say, that's all mythology. That's part of their religious belief. Now, we're going to have to step away for break. I'll let you answer that when we come back. We'll be back, folks, right after this. Back to the Kevin Smith Show. My guest this evening is John Jensen. He is the author of Ancient Canal Builders in America. And by the way, if you click his picture on my website, it'll take you to his website. We're on Final Approach. We only have a few minutes left. I ask a question. I posed a possibility before we went to break, and that is this. Great cataclysm hits us, wipes us off the face of the earth, except for maybe 1 million people. 1,000 years down the road, some of those people are keepers of the information, and they've written it down. They've preserved for the future the stories of the great exploits of this civilization before it was wiped out, including the first man on the moon. So 1,000 years forward, you go through 1,000 years or so of decline of technology because it's a derivative civilization. You hit a point where it begins to develop on its own then and starts struggling back upward. So 1,000 years into the future, someone reads those ancient documents about the first man on the moon, and because they do not have that capability, they say that this derivative civilization was simply mythologizing about their gods. What would you say to that?
Well, I understand the postulate, and, you know, extremely well. I've had this conversation, you know, several times in several arenas, and the way that you phrase the question makes it entirely plausible and entirely reasonable, and I don't have any comment to make about it, because it is a reasonable, the way that it's postulated. If you postulate it differently, you come up with a different set of responses. I just happen to postulate it differently than that. I don't have a dog in the fight of Zachariah Sitchin's truth or falsehood, or Sumerian truth or falsehood at all. I don't have any intent of really basing any of my findings on that basic structure. I really don't. I apologize if
no, that's fine. And by the way, this is your first time on the show, so you may or may not know. I don't believe anything. I either know or I don't know. And if I don't know, then it needs further investigation. But I'm just saying that I think there's every possibility that, just like the Mahabharata from India that talks about flying machines and talks about them in a very matter-of-fact way, I think there's every possibility that you have that same kind of thing recorded in many of these documents from derivative civilizations, where maybe it really wasn't religious and it wasn't allegorical. They were trying to tell us what actually took place.
Right. Let me just touch on one thing about because basically what you're talking about is Sitchin's ex-planet Nibiru kind of concept. The information that I'm uncovering says that the durations are not equal, or they're not exact. Mm-hmm. They're fairly regular, but they're not precise. Mm-hmm. In other words, the geological record shows that I've been able to dig up says that it averages between 5,500 years and 8,500 years, but averages 7,000. But it isn't precise at 7,000.
Mm-hmm. Okay, fair enough.
We can date to 7,100 years ago, and it's the average, but it's not precise. 3,100 years ago, something happened, and that's fairly well documented as well. And that's, so it's 3,000 to the last one, or 3,100 to the last one, and 4,000 or 1,000-year range. So it those two precise dates are too far apart to be to fall within something that would require celestial mechanics, meaning a planet circling into the outer reaches of the solar system to come back. That would have to follow celestial mechanics, which would put it on a very precise date, and we don't have that in the record.
Mm-hmm. Well, fair enough.
Precise.
Yeah. All right. Now, let me tell you this. I hope you're dead wrong.
Me too, man.
I hope you're dead wrong. I'm not saying you are. I'm saying I hope you are. I've got an old video here. It's a government-produced safety video. It's in the public domain, and it's about how to survive earthquakes. And it's particularly focused on the midsection of the United States along the New Madrid fault line. And they say over and over and over in this thing, it's not a question of if it's going to happen. It is going to happen. It's going to be major. It's going to be cataclysmic. And how will you survive? And this is an old film. It was originally produced in film. It was not videotaped. It was film.
Right.
And you know, we hear this kind of thing from a lot of different angles from a lot of different people that great cataclysms are upon us. And as a matter of fact, that film sort of predicted that it would happen by 2001, this big earthquake in the New Madrid fault line, right. Which, of course, it did not. And if the film is correct, we're way overdue. So, I think that great cataclysms are upon us, and I think that, and I've said this before, and I think the best thing that anybody can do is prepare as much as you possibly can, have your surfboard ready, and be ready to ride, and do your best.
Yeah, because if you live in New Orleans, you're going to surf to Denver.
And you don't even have to go through the TSA to do it. How about that?
Exactly. Anyway, I would like to thank you for having me on. I've really enjoyed it. I appreciate the kindness of your questions and the way that you've led it. You did an excellent job, and I really appreciate it.
Well, you're certainly welcome. Now, can folks buy your book? Is it available for sale?
No, it's on. It's most of the information that I have is on the website. It's not. And I'm still looking for a publisher that will publish it beyond an e-book I have on the website.
Okay, so the information is available. And, folks, if you go...
It's available at ancientcanalbuilders.com.
There you go. All right, if you will, stay on the line with me for just a moment as I bring this show in for a landing. Folks, if you go to my website, which is kevinsmithshow.com, if you're over there and you can't remember, you know, what is that, what's that web address? Just click on John's picture and it will take you to his website. And there's a load of great information there, very interesting. And, I recommend you read it. Maybe you think he's correct and maybe you think he is not. But I will say this, those who have written in forums that there's no such thing as these ancient canal builders, they're all wet. These ancient canal builders definitely existed, and the only reason Phoenix, Arizona is where Phoenix, Arizona is because of ancient canals that were discovered by a man named Jack Swilling. He reopened some of the canals, got the water flowing, made it fertile, farmland, and voila, there's Phoenix. They still use those canals today. It's real. My friends call me Steel Eye. My enemies do too. You can call me whatever you want. Just keep coming back again and again and again. Until next time, so long, everybody.